That's the Lagrangian. So it had these fields, scalar field, gauge field. Here's the symmetry. And here's the most general renormalizable thing. I called this C before. It's positive and real, so I'm calling it lambda squared just to emphasize it's positive and real. So what do you do? So what I want to do is analyze this thing perturbatively. So in perturbation theory, because what I'd like to know is what everyone would like to know is what's the, you know, what's the, if you calculate the Hamiltonian from this Lagrangian, diagonalize it. You know, what are the energy eigenstates, that kind of thing. And we know how to do that for quadratic Lagrangians. So, and this differs from a quadratic Lagrangian by this term and these terms, which all involve lambda and E. So I'm going to backstep away from perturbing lambda in a second, but we're going to think about lambda E being small and just think of this as being a special case of perturbation theory in quantum mechanics. So we're going to use perturbation theory, which involves taking the Hamiltonian or equivalently the Lagrangian and writing it as being some unperturbed thing and some interaction thing. And then the idea is that for the unperturbed thing, we know how to diagonalize the Hamiltonian. And so far, the only thing that we've talked about diagonalizing is the free particle Hamiltonian. And then we'll perturb everything in the interactions. And so if L naught is quadratic, then we know what the most general L naught can be. And that would correspond to something with a kinetic term and a possible mass term. And then we know how to figure out what the particle states are. We know the spectrum is going to be the no particle state, the one particle states, the two particle states, and so on. The energies will just add because they're not interacting, and so on. So we can already diagonalize the free particle thing. Find the n particle non-interacting states. And their energies are all characterized by the masses of the particles and the vacuum energy, which is basically controlled by a bunch of zero-point energies in A. So the spectrum on a bunch of masses. And so what we really like to do for the non-interacting part is read off what all the masses are. And then for the interactions, the idea would be that you now have all these energy levels to do with these particles. And then if you perturb in, if you find a small parameter which governs that, so that you can imagine it's a good approximation to that all the energy levels split by a small amount, or they move around by a small amount, or time-dependent things happen by a small amount, then you can just apply perturbation theory the way you would have done in quantum mechanics to calculate everything. And there's going to be one trick to do with, you want to make Lorentz invariance as manifest as possible, so you have to kind of rearrange a little bit the way you do the perturbation theory compared to what you would have done in as an undergraduate. But really, there's nothing conceptually in it beyond that. So in this case, the quartic and cubic terms are all proportional to E or lambda squared. So the expectation is that somehow, if those are small, this whole program should work. And there's going to be a question as to exactly, so perturbation small enough, E and lambda squared. So let's consider the two cases for the sign, depending on the sign of B. The first one will be B is positive. or it could be 0. And so let's say, to emphasize that, let's say it's B is plus mu squared. It had to be real because we wanted the Lagrangian to be real and phi star phi is real. So in this case, you know, the non-interacting Lagrangian would be just all the quadratic stuff here. So this plus this plus this, and I guess the A term, minus A. And then Lint is the rest. Instead of writing tautologies, let's just say the rest. And so if you look at, compared to what we did before, with the condition, if we also, if I take phi and write it in terms of real fields, we wrote things in terms of real fields before. If I write the, it's real and imaginary parts with the 1 over root 2 and half of it in front of it, then this would have become minus 1 half d mu phi 1 d mu phi 1 minus mu squared phi, sorry, plus d mu phi 2 d mu phi 2 plus mu squared phi 1 squared plus phi 2 squared. And that's exactly the standard form we had before. And you see that both these things have the same mass, corresponding to the particle and the antiparticle, in this case, having the same mass. And that's why it was useful. If we had tried, if we had had a mass that was different for phi 1 and phi 2, we could have also written it in terms of a complex field, but we would have had things like phi squared and phi star squared, and things which were kind of ugly. This has got a nice compact form in terms of the complex field because of the symmetry, which is making things only depend on phi star phi. And so if we'd had different masses for the two particles, it would have been simpler to write things in terms of real fields to start off with. I'm mostly writing this out to make you aware of this conventional factor of 2 that is there for real fields that makes contact with the way I was writing things before. So you might have missed them here. And that also tells you in particular that there's no factors of 2 hiding in here, that we can just read off mass. We know that this thing describes free particles whose mass is mu. And so we can see from that that just mu is equal to the mass of the scalars. Spin 0 particle. And the spin 1 particle is a separate piece too, and it's going to be massless. So we've done that exercise already. And so to the extent that we're perturbing around that is a good approximation. So if lambda is small and E is small, then we should be expecting to see, you know, two massive or a charged massive spinless particle interacting with massless spin 1 particles, and it'd be like scalar electrodynamics. And we could imagine calculating everything you want to calculate perturbatively in these various things. And that's what a lot of the rest of the term is about. But I want to focus, so that kind of plays out the way, this is kind of the way we're going to make contact with interactions. We're going to imagine that we're close to a system we understand. And in practice, and it's going to turn out in this course that the system that we're going to understand is one which is free particles. And in the case that B is positive, that connection is kind of fairly transparent because you're just factoring off the quadratic from the non-quadratic pieces. And in a renormalizable theory, it's if we had all the couplings are dimensionless, except if we had had a cubic interaction here, we could have had something which is not dimensionless. But all these ones are dimensionless, and so perturbing in those dimensionless couplings makes sense for them to be small in absolute terms because they're dimensionless. And so the approximation scheme, you know, you can control. But the case of B is less than 0 is more interesting. So let's say that B is minus mu squared. Then let's just ignore, supposing we ignore the, we imagined making the electromagnetic coupling very, very small and focus on the scalar interactions. Then Actually, first, I guess let me do the naive thing first. If I just repeat this exercise, then the only thing that's going to change is that this is going to be negative. So when we get here, we're going to get plus mu squared. And so we'd be led to believe that the mass is the square root of this thing. And so it would have been imaginary. And so that's really telling it that there's an instability in the problem. That if it were true, if we'd said that naively, if we said the mass was I times mu, then the energy would have been the square root of p squared plus the mass squared, which is now minus mu squared. And so for sufficiently small p, the energy is complex. So this would be, e real plus or minus I e imaginary for p small enough. And so the time evolution of these kind of states that have these energy eigenvalues is going to be e to the minus I e t. And so you can see that there's going to be, depending on the sign, this would be e to the minus I e r t plus or minus imaginary part times t. So this is something which is describing either something which is damped or blowing up. But because the whole problem is time reversal invariant, you can't have one without the other. So there's always a solution which is unstable here. So what that's telling you is that includes p equals 0, which is the case p not 0 is describing a sine wave in position space. So p equals 0 would be the constant configuration. And you can kind of see why there should be an instability if you look at the energy of phi all by itself, where you don't worry about it talking to the electromagnetic field. So if we temporarily ignore E, then for phi, we have Lagrangian is minus d mu phi star minus the potential. And if we focused on the p equals 0 mode just to make life easy, then for p equals 0, v was a minus mu squared phi star phi plus lambda squared phi star phi squared. And so if I complete the square, that's lambda squared phi star phi minus, what would it be here? We'd have isn't that right? Did I get that wrong? So I got the cross term, this thing squared would be that. The cross term would be, we'd lose the two. We'd have minus mu squared over lambda squared, and lambda squared's cancel, that gives us that. And this thing squared cancels that, leaving us today. Yeah, so I think that's right. So this is just a constant, don't worry about this. That's just telling us again what the vacuum energy is, which we don't really care about right now. But you can kind of see that if you plot this against if you write phi as being, a modulus times the phase, where v and theta are real, then nothing here depends on the phase. Let me write it as being as chi e to the I theta. Then v is just lambda squared, chi squared minus, let me just call this whole thing v squared plus a constant. And you can kind of see that if I plot that, what's happening is that for chi 0, it's just non-zero, and it goes down and touches 0. And touches, actually, I'm plotting this part here where I'm ignoring the constant. I guess I could leave the constant in. And this point here where the minimum is v, which is from that it's mu over the square root of 2 lambda. And so, what we've implicitly done here when we write when we identify this as being the quadratic part and this as being the quartic part, is we're expanding this potential around phi equals 0, which is this point here. And you know that classically, we wouldn't have expected that to be a good place to start, because we know that really, if I had a constant value of phi, it can minimize its energy by sitting over here rather than over here. So the expectation is that we should be thinking that we made an implicit assumption in doing this analysis and getting the funny mass. We made the assumption that phi was 0. It was a perfectly good solution to the equations of motion to have phi equals 0. But when we looked at the fluctuations around the equations of motion, we found that there were things that are growing in time. And that's something which we expected to find, given that we're at a maximum. And so that's expressing the fact that if I start off here and I perturb it all, I'm going to want to roll down here. And the exponentially growing solution is telling me how that rule starts. So that's kind of a generic thing. If you find that you're getting a mass squared which is negative for a boson, it's typically telling you that you started at the wrong place. And so we need to go back and think about what the energy is here. And the first thing to worry about is why should you believe a classical description of the energy? Because we're not interested in we have a quantum problem on our hands. So why should the classical description work? So. I guess the first thing I should have said is finding that m squared was minus mu squared indicates an instability. That's called a tachyon if you have a negative mass squared. And if I can believe this classical argument, the instability seems like it should be towards phi being non-zero in the vacuum. So I want to take an aside as to why we should believe the classical argument. Because the argument we're interested in perturbation theory where lambda and e are small. And it's not clear to start off with that should be the same thing as the classical approximation. So I want to first make an aside as to what justifies the classical approximation. So and for this, I just want to focus on the scalar, because the scalar is really all that's going on for this energetics argument. So we had, again, I'm going to write it over and over again. Oh, did I finish? Why should a classical picture of the energy work? Got to have a verb. So we had, let me throw the constant away because it's not really important. We had plus mu squared phi star phi minus lambda squared. So to make this the classical approximation clearer, let me do the change of variables where I take the coordinates x mu and I write them as being y mu divided by mu, this mu here. So if I use those variables, then the derivative d mu, d dx mu is going to become mu dy. Let me not use mu as an index just because that's going to be confusing. And let me also make the change of variables. Phi is some other field, what do we call the other field? Eta. Times a factor, and let's make the factor be mu divided by. So the only parameter here. We have two parameters. That one's dimensionless. That one has dimensions of mass. So why don't we just? And we know the field has dimensions of mass, and the coordinates have dimensions of 1/mass. Why don't we scale out the masses on dimensional grounds, and then whatever is left will be dimensionless. So that's why I'm pulling a factor of mu out of phi, and I factor 1/mu out of the coordinates. And then a nice thing is going to happen if I also scale out a factor of lambda squared here for phi. Because in terms of this, what will happen is that in terms of this new variable, I'm going to have an overall factor of minus mu to the fourth over lambda squared. And d mu a eta, d mu eta. So this is now the derivative vector y. So what happened here was I had a mu squared came from the derivatives, and another factor of mu squared came from the 2 powers of phi. That's why there's mu to the fourth. The 1 over lambda squared came because each phi had a, whoops. I wanted to have lambda. So there's 1 over lambda for each phi, and so I got an overall 1 over lambda squared there. If I look at this term, I'm going to now get plus eta star eta. The mu squared has come out front, and there's 2 mu's coming from the phi, so that's where the mu to the fourth came from. And again, I get 1 over lambda squared for the 2 phi's. And here I've got eta star eta squared. And again, now I got 4 mu's from the field, so that's where the mu's came from. I would have got 4 lambdas as well, but then I got 2 of them canceled by this factor up front. And so this change of variables has had the effect of putting all the parameters into one thing out front of the whole story. Did I get the signs wrong? Oh yeah, this one should have been minus and plus, right? Because I got the overall sign outside. If you played your cards right, you could have got 2 pennies. I think it's right now, right? So why do you care? You know, what are we going to do with this? In quantum mechanics, one way to think about this is that if you had been thinking about a path integral or something, what always appears is the action divided by h-bar. And the action divided by h-bar is the dimensionless thing that everything depends on in quantum mechanics. And so that's, you know, the integral d4x of Lagrangian divided by h-bar. So if I have an overall factor in front of this thing, like I do here, in this particular case, we would have had that this thing was mu to the fourth over lambda squared h-bar times something. And that shows you that when you have a coupling constant out front of the whole action, and if lambda is getting small, that means this whole thing is getting large. The lambda equals small limit is the same, with mu fixed, is the same as the h-bar goes to zero limit at some level. So if you wanted to count the corrections to the classical limit, that would have been the small h-bar limit. That's the classical limit is when the action is large compared to h-bar. And because this is coming out as an overall factor, the statement is that if I take lambda small with mu fixed and eta fixed, the whole action gets large. It's not I'm not making some terms in the action larger than other terms. Like if E is small, I'm making the quartic term, say, that I haven't written anymore here, small compared to the quadratic terms. It's making different terms have different sizes compared to each other. Lambda small with eta and mu fixed is making the whole action big. And that's the classical limit, because that's the same thing as h-bar. That's saying that you're making the action large compared to h-bar. And so that says that in terms of the original variables, if I have made lambda small with phi large, so eta had to be fixed, so that means that phi has to be kind of parametrically large in units of mu. That's the regime where we should believe classical field theory to work. And so the good news is that the value, you know, we believe this classical picture, but not for arbitrary values of phi. We believe it for sufficiently large values of phi because they had to be order 1 over lambda in order for this whole classical thing to work. And the good news is that the minimum we're looking at is in that region. It is order 1 over lambda, so that you know, you can believe kind of a semi-classical analysis. This is in the limit of lambda goes to 0 for sufficiently large fields. And we had to check, but we did check, that where we're interested in talking about is in that region. And so for the scalar fields, a semi-classical analysis makes sense because provided the fields are in the right spot, we should be worried a little bit about doing a classical, semi-classical analysis in here because in there, here the fields are not necessarily parametrically large. And so the lambda goes to 0 limit might be different from the classical limit. I didn't hear the first part of that. then you don't know. Yeah, so you have to treat it in a way which you can understand what's going on if lambda is not small. And so, and there are things you can do. You can put it on a computer, for instance, and look at the lattice way of formulating it. And this thing does have problems. Typically what happens is that if you start off in lambda small, say it was true that in this particular instance, this example is a bad example to talk about. If we had another field, you know, what sometimes happens is that there are fields whose couplings are proportional to. Oh, actually, that'll happen. If you hold that thought for a second, when we talk about the spectrum in this case, the spin one particle is going to get a mass, and it's going to be proportional to E. And so if you make E, but you only really believe that in perturbation theories. That means that you're believing for small E, the mass goes like E. And you could ask, if E gets large, what happens? And once E gets to be order one, if you graph the mass against E, you know, it starts off linear, but you don't necessarily, and if this is one, you don't believe it's going to go off forever at one. It could flatten off. It might not change at all once lambda is large, or it might bind into, you know, the particle you're interested in might be binding into other things, and the thing whose mass you're interested in might not be the what you thought was the elementary particles. A lot of interesting things can happen here, and what I'm doing would tell you nothing about it. But you just need to be careful that you don't try to extrapolate the small coupling things that we're going to talk about into that regime. And there are some things that are known, and so as I go along, particularly in the standard model, there's cases where there's strong couplings, and people know a fair bit about what's going on in those cases, and so I'll talk about those when I get there. But so far, all I'm saying is in the weak coupling. Can I have a tachyon what? Well, if you really, you know, if for, when you say tachyon, what that means to me is a spectrum like this. And so then you've said that the energy had an imaginary part. And so that is an instability, because you've said that there's a mode which grows exponentially. So if you started off there, you're not going to stay there because the mode takes off. Right, so now, if you're in the classical regime, what's the energy? So if we start from this Lagrangian, if I now put in all the other interactions again, so the Hamiltonian of the full L, you know, the L naught plus L int, the whole thing. If you just work out what it is, it's a Hamiltonian density. You know, H is the integral d3x of a Hamiltonian density. And the density classically is, you know, we had a Maxwell piece, so there's an energy from the Maxwell field, so there's an E squared plus B squared. And then there's the kinetic energy for the scalar field, so there's a dt minus ie a naught. Right, I guess let me say d naught a naught phi. And then there was a potential, right? So there was. So if you take that Lagrangian, do the canonical thing where you go from Lagrangian to Hamiltonian, this is what you'd get. And you would write this in terms of momenta or something, but you know, it's the same thing. And what's useful is that classically, it's a sum of positive things, right? If you're classically trying to minimize this thing, then the way you minimize it is you make each one of those terms separately zero. So, so it prefers to have E squared equals B squared equals zero, and it prefers to have D zero minus IE A zero phi equals zero, and it prefers to have V as small as possible. So this tells us, modulo issues of topology, that, you know, A mu is zero. it's not, you know, there are cases if you're on a torus or something, you can arrange for situations where E and B zero do not mean that A is zero. But let's not worry about boundary condition issues. So locally, A is zero if B and B is zero, and if A is zero, we can forget that term. And then this just says that phi. Whoops, I forgot the spatial derivative piece. There's also a grad phi piece, right? There's a. We also want to have grad minus IEA. So now A is zero. So this thing tells us we want phi to be constant, so we want d mu phi to be zero. And we can certainly choose that independently if A equals zero. And this says we want to choose the value of this constant to be the one that minimizes V. So choose phi equals phi naught, where, you know, phi naught minimizes. And that's so we want phi naught to be mu over root 2 lambda, which is what I'm calling little v. Between here and here, there is in the Lagrangian, but not in the Hamiltonian, because it's like if we'd been doing particle physics, or if we just, you know, q dot squared minus v as being the Lagrangian, then that goes to q dot squared plus v in the Hamiltonian. So kind of what, you know, kind of qualitatively, what's going on here is that this would be like saying that if you thought of the no particle state. What I'm telling you is a little bit of a lie. But if you thought of the no particle state here and the Fock space built out of it by creating particles you know, in the vacuum where phi equals zero, what this is saying basically is that the state that really is the thing that minimizes the Hamiltonian for the full system is not the no particle state. It's something which has been multiply occupied because it's more like a field eigenstate. And so it's something which it's like you've got a coherent state of written in terms of the particles here, this is a coherent state, and it paid you to really fill up the to populate the bosons here by an amount having no momentum. So we populated only the modes with p equals zero because we wanted to have an energy here which was phi was constant. So for the scalar fields, it paid us to populate those states, those zero momentum scalar field states, to that allowed us to lower the energy in a calculable way when lambda was small. And so if I now ask what are the if I write the no particle states, if I write the unperturbed and the perturbed Hamiltonian here, what I should really do is expand the field around its background value. And instead of using phi as the variable, I should use phi minus v as the variable and find creation annihilation operators in terms of that variable. And that variable will define new particle states about the no particle state here. But that no particle state here is going to be a complicated thing in terms of the no particle state here, built around phi equals zero. And in those notes for the field theory that you'll get for the other field theory course, which has all the Weinberg stuff in it, there's in the first part of it, it talks about non-relativistic field theory and coherent states. And so you can kind of see that connection in more detail in those notes. So the way to think about this is that these are bosons. There's nothing that stops you from loading as many as you like into the zero momentum state. And energetically, you prefer to do that. So you like to sit over here at the bottom. And if you do this for a statistical system, this is one way of thinking about Bose-Einstein condensation. If we'd been doing non-relativistic or relativistic bosons with a chemical potential, the steps you would go through would be very similar to what we're doing here. So, having said that, so what we should do is to, so the point is, you know, we're trying to split the Lagrangian into an unperturbed part and a perturbed part, but you have some freedom in that split. And you should choose the split to be the one which is the one that the theory wants to give you. And you should always choose, if you're in a semi-classical limit, to be near the vacuum, and then to expand your fields about the minimum value here. And then you should expect to find a whole bunch of little harmonic oscillators at the bottom. And those will be the particle states that you see when you're quantizing free fields. And they'll always have a positive mass, because the mass is really the curvature of this potential. And if you're at a minimum, you're guaranteed that they're all positive. And so, or they're all non-negative. Yeah, in a sense. Yeah, because you think about it, if I said that phi was some sum, or some integral d3p, v to the I, px, you know, a sub p, and complex conjugates, and then I say that now phi is v plus curly phi, and I'm going to say that curly phi is the integral d3p of, you know, e to the I, px, some new creation. Let me call them b, say b sub p plus complex conjugate. In principle, you can imagine calculating what these b's are in terms of these a's, and they're going to involve some sort of a shift. Yeah, we're going to choose a vacuum which is annihilated by b, and that's a complicated thing when written in terms of the things annihilated by a. And the reason I'm lying to you partly is that that's part of the reason. So what that means is that if I take the Fock space built around the minimum, if I had two minima, it's clearer. And I take the inner product between the ones here and here, they're all, the inner products are zero. But they tend to be zero if I take literally an infinite number of states. So I have arbitrarily high energy and an arbitrarily large volume. So I could get around that problem by putting things in a finite volume but large and having some cutoff in frequency. So I really have a large but finite number of states. And then in which case, then these overlaps would not be zero, and I could meaningfully connect them. But there's a separate thing which is also going on here, which I'm hiding from you a little bit, and that is that the reason that we get this thing looks like a harmonic oscillator, if you think of it in terms of the Hamiltonian, is because this was a harmonic oscillator. We basically had, you know, phi dot squared plus, you know, k squared phi squared or something. So it's you have two terms in the energy, but if you are literally looking at the zero momentum mode, then this term isn't here. And so as long as the mass is not zero, then I'm not lying to you, then it is a harmonic oscillator. But in the case that you have a massless direction, the better analog than a harmonic oscillator is a free particle. It's something which has a phi dot squared term and nothing else. And then you shouldn't be thinking in terms of harmonic oscillators, for that is much more like a plane wave. So there's two subtleties that I'm sloughing over because they're not really so important. And if you, it's done a little bit more carefully in these notes that you'll get done next week, I guess. But it's not, if I take a non-zero mass, it's not such a bad thing that I'm telling you. There is a problem with these guys because some of their energies are not real, so it's, what I'm saying would have made a lot more sense if we'd been doing it around another minimum somewhere rather than a maximum, because then we really would have had a bunch of sensible Fock states on, or harmonic oscillator states for both minima. Yeah, if I plotted it as a Mexican hat, there's really a trough there, right? And that trough is to do with, that's kind of why I'm hedging a little bit about the massless state. There's one mode which is more like a free particle than it is like a harmonic oscillator. And that's the one that moves along the bottom of the trough. It's a useful exercise to do, to take this system, cut it off with a finite number of modes and a finite volume, and actually just quantize it the way I'm telling you to, and keep track of these what the energy is for the various modes, and whether it's a harmonic oscillator in the sense it has both a phi dot squared term and another phi squared term non-involving time derivatives or not. And you'll see that the case where you have a flat direction and no spatial momentum quantizes differently, because it's more like it's the quantum mechanical analog of a free particle where the Hamiltonian is p squared over 2m and no potential, and it is p squared over 2m plus kx squared. If you know what I mean. I don't know if this is. It's a curlicue, which ask me about it if you're not happy with. So here, so a better approach is we'll write L is equal to L naught plus L interaction, but we'll identify this as being quadratic in A mu and phi minus V, call that curly phi, and not A mu and phi, which is what I was doing before. So if we do that, remember what Lagrangian was, it was, we always have the Maxwell guy. We had the constant and the potential. The kinetic term won't care about a constant here. V is a constant. You know, V, remember, is just mu over root 2 lambda. Am I going to have to do my algebra in my head here? It's, so if I expand this thing, I'm going to get, I guess I might as well keep that constant. So I'll have A plus mu to the fourth over 4 lambda squared. Now I'm going to do the expansion now for phi explicitly, a little bit more carefully. So I've got and then, so that's the potential. And we had the kinetic terms all around, so we had the V's drop out here because the derivative of V is zero. And then we had the things involving the A's and the phi. So we had a minus I E A mu. Then we had the phi phi AA piece, so that'll have a minus E squared . So if we want to pull off the quadratic piece, that means that L naught is now going to be, so it's minus 1/4 FB nu, is always minus A. So that's that one. The kinetic term here goes along for the ride. That's that one. Now, there's two complications here, right? If we look at this thing, we've designed it so that there's nothing linear here, right? If I take the V squared term here, that cancels out V squared. And so if I expand this out, this is going to be, I'll have V times phi plus phi star plus phi star phi. That's what this is, right? And then I would have had a V squared, which cancels out V squared. And so when I square everything, I'm going to get this thing squared. It will be quadratic in phi. So I'll have a minus lambda squared V squared phi plus phi star squared, plus things that are now cubic if I take this times this, and put something quartic when I take that thing squared. Here I've got a piece, which this has got two fields in it already, so I have to take the V's here. So I have a minus E squared, A mu, A mu. But here I get a piece which is kind of more bizarre, because I've got an A here. So if I take something linear in phi here, which will always have to be the derivative, then I can get something which has got one phi and one A in it. So it'll have a minus I E A mu V. E mu phi minus phi star, looks like phi star minus phi. So that's the unperturbed Hamiltonian or Lagrangian. And if it wasn't for this last thing, the rest of the stuff we could recognize, right? This looks like a spin one particle which has a mass term. And this looks like a spin zero particle which also has a mass term for one of the combinations. But this sucks, right? Because it's something which we don't know, we haven't dealt with yet, where we've got a phi and an a which are tied to each other. And so it doesn't have the form that we can just easily read off what's going on. But this is where we can use some of the symmetries of the problem to make life easy for ourselves. So up until now, I haven't really followed. You know, we had a symmetry where phi went to e to the I omega phi, and a went to a plus d mu omega, I guess 1 over e. And so, in particular, what I can know, you can see that the important thing here is that it's the imaginary part of phi that's mixing with a, and not the real part of phi. So I can always use this symmetry to make phi real, and so I can use the freedom. You know, this is something which didn't change anything. It's not only a field redefinition; it's one for which the Lagrangian doesn't change at all, term by term. So if I do this field redefinition, I have the same Lagrangian as before. I'll rearrange terms in here, but if I use the freedom to do this field redefinition to set the imaginary part of phi equals 0, it'll have the convenient feature that if I split it into this unperturbed and perturbed part, the unperturbed part will be simple to think about. So this symmetry, choose phi equals real. And so if that's been done, then phi would become then v plus little phi, where phi is also real. And so with that choice, so what we get is that L naught just becomes, you know, minus a minus 1/4 f nu. Actually, it's not. I guess I forgot this term here. That's exactly what I'm doing. Yeah. So I might as well, for conventional terms, write this as phi over root 2. In fact, why don't I pull an overall? Well, I'm stuck with it now. Let's just leave it like this. So now what we have here is the quadratic piece here is we have lambda squared, v squared. I have a 1 over root 2 here. So I got phi plus phi star is now 2 phi over root 2. So it's like a root 2 phi. I square it, so I'm going to get a 2 phi squared. And this doesn't change. So we've got minus e squared, v squared, k mu, a mu. And this term is now 0 because that's 0. So this ends. Period. So like you said, using the freedom, the fact that there's such a powerful freedom here because this omega depends on positions, it allows you to remove a complete field. The imaginary part of phi is something which is I don't need to really think of as being a physical degree of freedom because I can always remove it with a symmetry, and the symmetry did nothing because it was a symmetry. So that this freedom, this was called a gauge symmetry, right? Because it varied, the parameter depended on space and time, and a choice like this, which is just a conventional choice which removes the symmetry, is called a gauge choice. And one that's been chosen in this particular way to make the quadratic parts of the Lagrangian not mix terms of different spin is called unitary gauge. Or sometimes it's called unitarity gauge. But there might be other gauges that are convenient. In the notes for the standard model, we're going to mostly use unitary gauge, because what's nice about unitary gauge is it makes the spectrum of particles easy to read. But if you're interested in following the Lorentz invariances of loops for doing quantum corrections, there's another gauge which is more convenient, which makes gauge invariance makes Lorentz invariance and gauge invariance makes renormalizability manifest. And it uses a different trick to get rid of it. It's also arranged to get rid of this term, but it does it in a different way than this, and it does it in a way for which when you actually calculate the perturbative corrections, it's easier to understand what's going on. And that's called C gauge or renormalizable gauge. And so in the appendix, there's Feynman rules given for two gauges, and that's what those two things are. But I won't really tell you more about the renormalizable gauge until later on, when I can tell you what it is. So that's something which is I'll come back to later on. But this is the unitary gauge choice, and it's just defined to be the one for which the quadratic Lagrangian is nice to think about. Sorry? For any one vacuum, I think it's right. Yeah. I mean, it's a good gauge. To be a good gauge, you have to completely remove the symmetry. And then, so one way of asking what you're asking is that if you're looking at a particular vacuum like phi equals v, once you've gone to unitary gauge, is there any remaining freedom that you can choose to simplify things even further? And there's a sense in which that's going to be true in the standard model, that once we do this in the standard model, it's not going to take all the gauge freedom to make the free Lagrangian quadratic and not mix the various spins. And so we're going to still have freedom to do electromagnetic gauge transformations in that particular case. So sometimes that happens, that you haven't used the complete gauge freedom. So then to completely fix the gauge, you have to do something else to nail it down. But it's all specific to a specific vacuum. If you now go over to another vacuum, if you had more than one vacuum, then you'd have to ask the unitary gauge question vacuum by vacuum, because these mixing terms depend on things like V, which are vacuum specific. Does that answer your question? Is that? Yeah. All right. So in this gauge, we're in business, because now, you know, we're in the business of reading off things. And the whole point of the earlier exercise was that we can just look at this thing, because the kinetic terms are in standard form, we can just read off the mass. This should have been minus 1/2 m squared phi squared. And this should have been minus 1/2. So this is the spin zero particle. And this would be minus 1/2 m squared a mu a mu, if it was a standard massive spin one particle. So you can read off the mass as so the spinless particle has a mass which is two lambda v. So in terms of the original variables, remember v was mu over root 2 lambda. So that would be root 2 mu. I think that's right. And for the spin 1 particle, m1 is equal to square root of 2 ev. That sounds funny, actually. So in terms of this is I think there's some funny root 2s compared to what's in the notes, because I think in the notes I divided that by root 2. So there's a conventional issue that's going to make it look different from the notes, and that's why those formulas, they don't look like what I expect them to be, and that's because I think what I mean by V is actually different from what I've used in the book. But I think that's right. I mean, all I'm doing is I'm comparing the standard form we found to what we actually got when we expanded things out around the vacuum. Now, you might have been surprised, because I made a big deal that spin 1 particles, massive and massless, are different qualitatively because there's more spin states. The massive particle has 3 spin states, and the massless particle has only 2 spin states, 2 helicity states. And that's true, but it still works here because the counting of states is the same. If we had had if we'd been in the phi equals 0 vacuum, we had a massless spin 1 particle and 2 massive spin 0 particles, that had the same mass. So if I, let's compare that to this. So if we had had if b was equal to plus mu squared, this is the case b equals minus mu squared. Then we had this is a real, right, spinless particle. And here we had a complex, which is like two real spinless particles with the mass was mu. And then we had one massless spin one. So altogether, we had two states here for each of the real scalars. And here we had two spin states. So we have for each of the two helicities of the spin one particle, it's massless, giving us a total of four spin states. Whereas here, we've got one spinless particle. So we've got one state. And we've got one massive thing, which has got three states. So the states have reorganized themselves in how they are transforming under rotations, where one of the scalars got eaten by the massless spin one to become a massive spin one. So this transference of one scalar into a vector is called the Higgs mechanism. And it's, you know, what you see, the words are that the scalar was eaten by the vector to become massive. And you can kind of see explicitly that it's the longitudinal part of the vector that did it. You know, what would be the transformation you'd have to do? If I'd written phi was chi e to the I theta, then the one way of thinking about this gauge we're going to is that we're choosing omega to be minus theta to get rid of the phase of phi. But if we do that, then A shifts by the derivative of theta. And so this the derivative of something is the longitudinal part of the mode that was not supposed to be there. If we have a massive field, a vector field had to satisfy the divergence was zero to be a massive spin one particle. And it was the divergence which is the thing which is knows about the longitudinal mode that I'm going to get just confused when I say this because in a very qualitative way, which if you push me on, you're going to force me to admit I'm lying. This is a longitudinal mode. And so the missing spin state, you had for massless spin one, you have the plus or minus helicities. And the thing that's missing is the longitudinal state, which is qualitatively what this is. And you can kind of see that it's eaten the piece of the scalar field that you could change that shifts under the gauge transformation. So even though we started off with what looked like a massless spin a half spin one particle, depending on if we went to the real vacuum, it was really describing a massive spin one particle. And so the other degree of freedom was hidden in the scalar field. And that's kind of a general thing. There's a lot of things that are written about some more in gravity now. It used to be, you know, 30 years ago, it was for spin one particles. People talk a lot about the mass singularity or the discontinuity if you take the mass of a spin one or a spin two particle to zero, and how cross sections and things are not smooth in that limit. And the statement is not wrong, but it's kind of irrelevant at some level because what it's saying is that if you had a massive spin one or a spin two field and you literally took the mass to zero, there's a discontinuity because you had three states originally and then the massless limit had only two states and you can't continuously go from three to two. The smooth limit from a massive field where you take the mass to zero is you go from a massive spin one particle to a massless spin one and a mass and a scalar. That's the limit that you should expect to be smooth, and it typically is smooth. If you look at the standard model or you look at this theory and you dial the mass to zero, make V, you know, take mu to zero, so it goes from B goes from negative to positive values. That's a parameter change which will make this thing massless, the spin one particle massless. And everything's perfectly smooth in this theory. If you calculate any physical process, it'll be nice and smooth. It's just where you put the burden as to what was being done by the massive vector particle or the massless vector and the scalar particle is just changing. But the answers are all perfectly smooth in that limit. And the same thing's true for spin two. If you take a massive spin two, it's going to be massive because if it's light, it's gauge invariant and its symmetry is being broken in the same way and there's going to be a vector field somewhere, which is the thing that got eaten by the massless spin two to give it the five spin states that it has to be massive. And the smooth limit will always be from a massive spin 2 to a massless spin 2 plus some other fields, which are the ones that got eaten. So you may not have cared about that, but if you someone in a dark alley tries to tell you about discontinuities as masses go to zero, part of it is a swindle. But the price might be good, so you might want to buy. So that's all I really want to say about this model. In principle, we could now go off and calculate everything. We could calculate corrections to these masses. You know, if we have interactions, and what we should expect is that if we have the single particle states are given by, or if this is the one particle state, this is the two particle state, and the energy of that state over the vacuum is at zero momentum is given by the mass, you turn the interactions on, and these states are all going to change a little bit. And so you should expect that the honest to God mass of the given by the energy eigenstates of the Hamiltonian won't be, for the full theory, as simply related to the parameters of the free theory. So we won't expect to have the mass was equal to mu in this case as an exact statement. The interactions will correct it. So you expect the real mass will be mu plus e squared times this other thing. So there's going to be corrections to all these masses in perturbation theory just because all the levels move around in energy as you turn on the perturbation. And we could calculate those things, and people do calculate those things, and that's a whole industry in itself. Or we can calculate scattering, and we will calculate scattering for all these particles. All I really want to focus on here is the name of the game was to choose carefully what the non-interacting part of the Lagrangian was you wanted to perturb around. And if you do, you can make it look like the cases that we studied when we're looking at free field theories. And you should expect the free field theories to be a good approximation to the exact spectrum if these interaction terms that are not quadratic, like the phi star phi AA terms, all their coefficients are small. So you have to go check that in this case it means that E is small and lambda squared small. The second thought is that in these gauge theories, it's typically useful to choose a gauge which makes your life simple when you're looking at the quadratic part of the Lagrangian, because then it's easy. The absence of these mixing terms makes it easier to identify from what we did before what the spectrum is. If you didn't want to choose that gauge and you kept these terms, things are harder to calculate, but the answers are the same. So you're just making your life easier. You're not changing the answer when you make these gauge choices. You mean if I go to the standard model and ask what's the analog of V? You're skipping ahead, but it's a good skip. So what's going to happen is that it depends on the questions you ask. If you ask a question at energies that are high enough, they're all small. And the reason I had to qualify it was that these couplings actually all depend on the energy you look at them. And so in particular, for the weakened, there's the couplings that you're talking about in the standard model are the gauge couplings, and there's three of them, and then a whole bunch of Yukawa couplings, of which there's basically one for every particle, every fermion, and then the scalar self-interactions, and the Yukawa couplings and the scalar self-interactions, if you know the mass of the particle, you know the size of the coupling, and the bottom line is that if the mass of the particle is less than 240, it's always the couplings are something like. The Yukawa couplings are of the order of the mass of the particle involved divided by the analog of V, which in the standard model case is 246 GeV. So as long as your particle is light compared to 246 GeV, then the expansion, the thing that controls perturbation theory turns out not to be lambda. It's really lambda over 4 pi, or lambda squared over 4 pi. So even if lambda is 1, you're not doing too badly in the real thing that's counting perturbation theory. The problem comes when lambda gets to be of the order of the square root of 4 pi. And so the heaviest particle in the standard model that we know about is the top quark, which is 180 GeV. So it's actually, those couplings are all in good shape. The Higgs particle hasn't been found yet, but the best evidence is that it's 100 and something GeV. But that depends, it's kind of inferred that by looking in detail at the quantum corrections of things, everything works best if the mass was there. But it might be that that's completely wrong because there's other particles we haven't discovered yet that are completely screwing things up. But if it's true that it's just the standard model, then the best description would be that all those couplings are small. The gauge couplings, there's the electromagnetic one, there's the two that describe electromagnetism and the weak interactions, and those are all small for the same reason the electromagnetic one is. And the only one that's troublesome is the strong interactions. And that one depends on scale. And the higher energy you go, the lower it is. And so once you're above something like, once you're at, you know, at 80 GeV or something like that, that's small enough that you can do perturbation theory. Actually, anything above about 5 or 6 to 10 GeV, it's small enough that you can perturb in. But it becomes large when you get down to about a GeV. And that's why most of the strongly interacting bound states that are made from quarks have masses that are around a GeV. And so if you're asking questions at the GeV or lower energies, which involve strongly interacting particles, then perturbation theory is not working. And you have to work harder. But that, so there's a restricted part, which is hard to do, which is to do with the bound states of the quarks that are binding because of the strong interactions. But if you don't ask those questions, or if you ask specific kinds of questions for that, then you can phrase it in a way which perturbation theory works fine. So it's not an empty exercise to do this, because it really is part of the reason we know so much about the standard model is that it has been accessible through perturbation theory, and it's, so you can actually calculate and compare, and it really agrees with what you see. The last thought before we can close chapter one is, yeah. Oh, past that, yeah, they can already go past 246. So the Tevatron is already colliding things that it depends on how you count. Yeah, but the Tevatron is colliding protons with protons, and so the protons have a center mass energy of about 200, about TeV or so, like 1,000 GeV. But the protons are each made of quarks and gluons, and so what counts is really the energy carried by the quark and gluon, which is about a sixth. It turns out the quarks carry about half the energy of the proton. And so if you're looking at quark-quark scattering to produce a Higgs, they each have access to a sixth of the energy that's available, so that the quark-quark scattering is happening at energies that are lower, kind of not so far from this. And then the Higgs could be there, but you have to be able to see it, and the Higgs is something which doesn't interact very strongly. And the things it decays into tend to be things that are also decayed into by electromagnetic interaction, so the trick is to pull it out of the background, it turns out. So they're probably producing it all over the place in the Tevatron, and just no one's been able to find it, because its decays are into things that are easily hidden by other interactions. Well, the LHC will be better, because the LHC, all the energies are higher, so the quarks and the gluons will collide with a higher energy. And it depends a little bit what the mass of the Higgs is, what the best channel is, but it's been designed to find the Higgs, so that if the Higgs is there, it won't be the kind of thing that just pops out at you. There's a big peak somewhere, and that's the Higgs. But it's the kind of thing which, if it's there, if it's the standard model Higgs is there with that kind of mass, they'll know it's there. The worst case scenario is if it's as small as it can possibly be, because it's hard, I think, harder to find a light Higgs than it is to find a heavier Higgs, because of these background issues. Once the Higgs is heavier than a pair of W bosons, it can decay into two W bosons, and it has more channels that it can decay into, which are, it tends to be the Higgs that's too light decays into two top quarks if it can. It decays into the heaviest thing that's lighter than it, where two things. If it's going to decay into a pair, the pair has to be, because the couplings are proportional to the mass, the heaviest one wins, but it then has to be not so heavy that it's not allowed energetically. And so if you get it below the top quark, then it decays into B quarks, and then there's other things decaying to B quarks that are hard to see. So there's a kind of a window where it's tricky to find, but it's the LHC will find it if that's all there is. If that's all they find, then we're fucked, because the standard model, we're hoping you're going to find something that's different from the standard model. If it's the standard model only, then we're in the same boat we are now, except we know it's true. But it could be true right up to really high energies, and then we'll never know what the, it'd be really hard to figure out what the corrections are to it. But the best, hopefully what they're going to find is this Higgs and a whole shitload of other things. And then we'll learn a lot more. The one thought I wanted to close with was the non-abelian case. So if you have more than one spin one particle, because we are going to have more than one spin one particle, what do you do? And rather than, so the hard way to do this would be to do all the things I'm telling you could do for supergravity, you can do for gravity. It's just that they're really hard to do this way. You can kind of construct the invariant just laboriously in perturbation theory. And so for the spin one thing, I want to cut to the chase and tell you what the answer is. So. So you remember the story was that the first thing you try is you couple a Noether current to the spin one particle. So we have some matter stuff involving spin a half and spin zero particles. We have some kinetic terms for the spin one particles. And then we try something like you know, J mu, A mu. And if we have more than one, we can imagine that there's a more than one current for now alpha will be one to the number of spin one particles. And this doesn't always work, because if this involves scalars, there's a derivative, and you have to have an AA term. And if there's a, if the symmetry that we're interested in, that A is coupling to, that this is the current for, it may be that even for constant parameters, the current is not invariant if the group is not abelian. And there's lots of things which will force us to add other things here and to the symmetries. And I'm just going to tell you what they are, rather than doing it constructively. Yeah. One to the number of spin one particles. Up until now, there's only been one, but now I'm imagining there's n of them. And there's going to be, you know, there's going to be eight and four is 12 in the standard model. So, so general Lorentz invariant unitary, you know, blah de blah de blah, couplings can be found as before by gauging if this thing has, if the matter Lagrangian has a symmetry and you have one symmetry parameter for every gauge field or more, then you can construct interactions like this. Symmetries of L matter, provided there is at least one symmetry for each gauge or spin one particle. And so so suppose generically that suppose L matter is invariant under some linear transformation of the fields. So delta phi I is, I'm going to write it this way. So I times some parameters times some matrix d alpha ij phi j. So this is just a Hermitian matrix. And this is I. And this, these are the parameters. These are the. Then imagine that this is invariant under this, where omega is a constant. And the idea is we're going to promote this into a symmetry where omega is not a constant by also having these gauge fields transform. And the deal will be that I'm just going to give you a prescription on how to do it. But I want to tell you some more about these T's first. So these T's typically, you know, this is an infinitesimal version of a transformation of the form phi goes to some matrix G of omega times phi. And there'll be some group multiplication rule, right? If I take, you know, G of omega 1 times G of omega 2, I'm going to get some new G in the group because it's a group which is depends on omega 1 and omega 2. And for we're typically interested in transformations which are both unitary and finite dimensional, because we're going to have finite numbers of fields here. So we're looking at transformations that are always described by finite dimensional matrices. And typically, they're unitary. And what's the general argument for that? I mean, typically, one way to think about it is that any symmetry of the full theory will be, in particular, a symmetry of the kinetic terms. And the kinetic terms are always invariant under, if you have n real fields, you can always do an n by n orthogonal rotation of those things. And so the symmetry we're thinking about sits inside n by n orthogonal transformations. And so we're thinking of a specific class of finite and orthogonal things that are, in particular, the real unitary. And it's a theorem that if you have a finite dimensional representation of a unitary group, then operationally, I'm thinking, think of this thing as being a special case of an ON. If we have n real fields here, think of it as being the ON transformation that rotates that whole column. If I wrote phi 1 to phi n in a column vector, then I can multiply this by an n by n orthogonal matrix, and that won't change the kinetic terms, because the kinetic terms are always d mu phi I, d mu phi I. So to be a symmetry of the whole thing, in particular, you're typically going to have to be a symmetry of this as a special case. So since this has an invariance under this, making it an invariance of the interactions and all the other stuff will give me a subset of this, of this n by n transformation. So I'm thinking of it being sitting inside an n by n orthogonal transformation. And it's, and if these are real, it's real orthogonal, so it's unitary. It's unitary in the sense that it's real orthogonal. And I was going somewhere with that thought, and I can't remember where I was going now. But it was good. The bottom line is that all of these groups, the ones, there's a classification theorem of all the compact Lie groups. And they there's a list that's been discovered once for all, the Cartan classification. There's the orthogonal groups, there's the unitary groups, there's the symplectic groups, and there's an infinite number of each of those, because they, you have n by n matrices for all of them, and n could be anything. And then there's the exceptional groups, of which there are, you know, 6 or 8 or something like that. So in practice, we're talking about those groups. And the group multiplication law for them is known, and it's encoded in these matrices, because these matrices are related to these matrices by exponentiation. So these being unitary is why these are Hermitian. And if these are orthogonal, which they're really going to be, then these are not only Hermitian, they're imaginary because of that factor of I. So we're thinking of them being imaginary Hermitian, which is to say they're also antisymmetric. And that's just coming from the choice of using real fields. But this, the group multiplication law, whatever it is, implies a statement about these t's. And what it implies is a commutation relation, that t alpha with t beta will be given by some coefficients, gamma alpha beta. So this is a linear combination. The commutators of the t's are linear combinations of the t's. And that's, I'm pulling that out of the air. There's some words about it in the appendix of the book. But it's just an expression of the group multiplication property when you have a continuous family of groups, a continuous several parameter continuous family of group elements. And this is going to be important down the road. These are called the structure constants. And they're called that because they're characteristic of the group. If you tell me what the group is, SU2 or SU3 or, you know, E6, then in principle I know what all these things are. And they depend a little bit on how I normalize these generators. Like if I scale these things by some number, then I change what all these numbers are. But in some conventional normalization, these things are characteristic of the group. And so rather than talking about this, it's more convenient to talk about this as being the thing that describes the group. And so I told you that to tell you this. The way you make an invariant Lagrangian is, so if L matter of phi and d mu phi is invariant with respect to delta phi I is, you know, I omega alpha t alpha phi I. Let me not use I for everything. Let's call it K, maybe. So if this is invariant where omega is a constant, then the thing we're looking for is going to be, first of all, there'll be a gauge kinetic term for each of the spin 1 particles. And we'll come back to this in a second. And then there's going to be the matter Lagrangian, where I replace phi, the derivative here, by d mu phi. So d mu phi is partial phi minus I times t alpha phi, or yeah, t alpha a alpha mu. Mu phi. Start again. D mu phi k
is partial mu phi k minus I times t or a alpha mu t alpha phi k. And f alpha mu nu is partial mu a alpha nu minus partial nu a alpha mu plus c gamma alpha beta a, sorry, alpha beta gamma. Just a sec, let me get back to that.
You're asking, is there not a coupling constant here? I'm using a convention where that's absorbed into T. And so so that means it's also absorbed into C, because the T, two T's was a C. So if I scale T by G, then I'm going to get a factor of G in the C. So what? Yep. And all it does is, it just means that what you thought these C's were are going to change. So if I multiply everybody by a constant, then I have to multiply this by a constant too. Oh, okay, let me rewrite it over here then. So let me make a sentence out of this. You can read the Lagrangian, right? I'll just rewrite this again. And this, where d mu phi is partial mu phi k, invariant with respect to the following symmetry transformations. Delta phi k is I omega alpha t alpha phi k. Delta a alpha mu is partial mu a alpha, partial mu omega alpha plus c alpha beta gamma omega beta a gamma mu. And omega is clearly not a constant. So it's just the non-abelian generalization of what we did before. Everywhere you had a derivative, if you promote it to a covariant derivative, which is defined by this, and where you can just read this off if you know what the symmetry transformations are, then if you also promote the field strength to have this new term, and then change the add a new term to the which is linear in A to the transformation of A, then provided that this was already invariant under this, then this new thing is going to be for free invariant under the transformations where the omega is now local in space and time. And I haven't used it as renormalizable here. I didn't tell you had to just take something. I guess I did when I wrote this. So more generally, I could have said this is some Lagrangian built out of f alpha mu nu, where I contract all the indices and make a gauge invariant. And it doesn't have to be a sum. So this could be a function of phi d mu phi, where that's the covariant derivative. So as long as I start off, when I turn all the gauge fields off, I get to something which is invariant under the symmetry, then the gauge fields are just telling you for free how to promote that into something which is invariant under local symmetry. And so for the standard, so you can see that the U1 case is a special case where all these C's are zero. If I only have one generator, it commutes with itself, so C is zero. And so that would be zero, and then we have our old field strength back. And this would be zero, so we have our old transformation rule back. And that's the abelian case. But for the scalar field, I had already built things out of the covariant derivative, and the covariant derivative squared contained the AA phi phi term, which we saw we needed already. And for fermions, the Dirac action is linear in the derivative, so I only get something involving two fermions in a gauge field. So for the standard model now you're ripe for the standard model. All you have to do now is know what are the symmetries, what are the spin one particles, what are the symmetries that go with them, and what is the matter, the spin zero and spin half stuff, that and how do they transform under the symmetries. So I just need to tell you what are these, what's the field content, what are the phis, what are the symmetries that are relevant for the spin one particles, and then the group theory will tell me what all this stuff is. It'll tell me what this is, it'll tell me what this is, it'll tell me, if it's renormalizable, it'll tell me also that I have only F squared, and then the renormalizable things I could have written down, which are were constrained to be invariant under the symmetry. And you'll see that that makes, that's a, if you take all the particles that have been discovered so far, that actually is quite constraining. There's not a lot of freedom left in that. And the Higgs particle has not been discovered, and if you add that, it kind of complicates things a lot. So that's, I'll pick that up next time there. So if you came in late and you didn't pick up, the chapters 4 through 7 are here.